Welcome to TFP, the Theater Folk Podcast. I am Lindsay Price, resident playwright for Theater Folk. Hello, I hope you're well. Thanks for listening. We've got another interview today, this time with playwright Ken Proos, rhymes with Seuss, who has a fascinating doorway into the creative process. But first, let's do some Theater Folk news. Did you catch the latest edition of our Spotlight newsletter? It's all about the duet, the two-hander scene, which might be a Canadian thing. I've referred to duets as two-handers in the past before, and sometimes have received, like, blank stares, like they've never heard of it before. It's a very foreign thing. I don't know, could have been because I had something in my teeth, I digress, but it's one person talking to another person. And we look at it at the newsletter from an improv perspective, an acting perspective, and a writing perspective. We also got some teachers to say what their favorite two-person scenes were to use in the classroom. And if you're sitting there and you're listening and you don't know what I am talking about, well, we offer a free theatrical newsletter, 10 issues a year. And our aim is to make the newsletter as practical as possible with play analysis, exercises, resources, questions, everything that you can use in the classroom. All you have to do to sign up is visit our website, scroll to the bottom, and enter your email. Do it. Lastly, where, oh, where can you find this podcast? We post new episodes every Wednesday at theaterfolk.com and on our Facebook page and on Twitter. You can also find us on the Stitcher app, and you can subscribe to TFP on iTunes. Why not? All you have to do is search on the word Theater Folk. Hi, Ken. How do you say your last name?
Proos.
Ken Proos. So I am here with Ken Proos.
Rhymes with Dr. Seuss.
Dr. Seuss. That's a good way to remember it. And you are new to the Theater Folk Global Empire.
Family.
Family. The Theater Folk family. We like to think of it as it's a very small family, but a family nonetheless.
Global Empire sounds cool too, though.
It's so funny because we jokingly call it the Theater Folk Global Empire because it's Craig and I.
Two people.
In our pajamas in our house.
You know? my Global Empire is just me, so you're twice the size of what I've got going.
Well, there you go. So, you have joined us with your play, Epic Adventures in a Rinky Dink Ark Museum.
Very nice.
Aha! That's pretty good because I don't have it in front of me.
I went to auditions and the students were complaining that the title was too long.
Yes.
Well,
that's a good complaint. The only complaint they have.
Yeah, well, actually, it was actually longer when I started. There was a routine field trip wedged in there. And it was Epic Adventures on a routine field trip to a... See, I even got confused there. That's why I cut it short.
If you get lost in the middle of your title, then there's...
There's
something that needs to be revised. What number of play is Epic Adventures? How many plays have you written?
I have written 11 plays. Mm-hmm. 10 have been published, and one keeps bouncing from publisher to publisher. And it's just
It's the lost love.
It is.
That doesn't find a home.
It is. But that was the 11th one that I've written, the 10th one I've published.
Cool.
And unfortunately, it's the last one I've written thus far because I'm in a writing slump.
Oh, no.
But I will get out of it.
Of course.
Before my global empire crumbles.
Before Rome burns to the ground. So what was your first play?
The first one I wrote when I was in middle school, teaching middle school, was one called... Wishful Thinking about, it was kind of a parody of the Monkey's Paw where students made wishes and of course they don't come true the way they want them to. And I wrote it because I was going to direct the play and I didn't find a play I really liked, so I wrote one myself and that kind of got the ball rolling.
Was that sort of the impetus? Have you always been interested in playwriting or?
Well, I've always been a writer, through high school and college, but I didn't really write plays. But when I started teaching language arts and drama at the middle school level, everything I've ever written in my life, starting in high school, was about high school students. And my body and my I've grown up, but the part of my brain that writes has stayed in high school. So everything I write is always high school interactions with each other and with the real world. So it's just a natural fit, you know. Working with the middle school students, I actually wrote it very strangely. I guess it's strange. I don't know if other people have done this. I had an idea for the play. Yeah. I wasn't sure of all the characters, so I actually had some dialogue written, but I had auditions right before Christmas. I auditioned students. I videotaped the auditions. Then I went home during the break. I decided which students I wanted, and then I wrote parts specifically for the kids I wanted to be in the play.
For their voices.
Right, and it kind of rounded out the cast. I knew I wanted, you know, a handful of different type of students in the class, but I was able to, you know, write a part for the cheerleader girl. Instead of it being just a generic cheerleader, I based it on this girl who auditioned, and I kind of gave her a more, yeah, I guess, fleshed out character. And the quiet, shy boy, you know, became a character, and the really loud, obnoxious kid, because he auditioned for the play, he had to be in the play. So I wrote, you know, I wrote parts based on particular students, and it really made the play, you know, terrific. Then, unfortunately, after Christmas, some of them
half the dropped out.
Yes, I would say half, but there was about two or three. So then I was casting new students in roles that were specifically written for others. But that showed me that the writing worked, because they were, yeah, able to step in and create those characters. So.
Yeah. Well, what you did was create, you were writing based on a real human being. So ergo, the character was a human being.
Right.
So that means that anyone, but you're quite right, if anyone can step into the shell of the character and make it come to life, then that's a real,
and
you know,
that gave me some confidence to do it again.
To do it again.
I have to admit, the first three plays I wrote, I did the same process. I kind of wrote the skeleton of the play. I auditioned students that I really wanted, and then I kind of curtailed the parts to match their.
I think everyone's process. I think the process is the one that works and gets the play finished, right?
Right.
And you know, the thing that you can use to get a play done and then put on its feet is the one that is the successful one. You know, because that happens all the time. Like when I'm teaching. You know, well, how do I write? Well, you put a pen on a piece of paper and then you keep going. And how do we get, particularly with students, because that's what I focus on, how do we just get them from A to B and get that finished product?
Right. So I remember you talking, you always write first with
pen and paper. I do. I always have. I mean, I love my computer, and I would never give up technology, to the point where I wrote a play this year on an actual typewriter. And then after I got a first draft done and was ready to sort of really get into the heart of rewrites, I went, I can't do this anymore because I'm so caught up with the formatting and the spelling. Oh my God, the spelling. Right. And it's like, I'm interfering with my process. So I have to use the technology, but I love the first act of pen on paper, and also it was the same thing on the keyboard, typewriter keyboard. That just first, it's very tactile.
It is.
I like the tactile.
I always tend to start with a sheet of paper, and instead of writing, I draw. Like in my mind,
neat.
I draw cartoons, but I draw these little, they're just stick, not even stick, shadow figures, if you will. But picture, okay, here's the girl, and I would draw like a little line. Okay, here's the boyfriend. I'll sketch out the characters, and I might jot a word or two down. But I have several notebooks at home that still have. You know, I can look at it and say, this was the first moment.
Did you do that for Epic Adventure?
I did. I drew the security guard to one side.
Yes.
Here are the two boys that are the goofballs that are hanging together. And here's our main girl and her best friend who are trying to solve this, you know, deep, dark mystery.
Yeah.
Then I have a little side bubble. Okay, here's the backstory of the mystery. And I draw these little, you know, cartoons. And it's all there. And sometimes I can look at it and it makes perfect sense to me. If I showed it to a stranger, it would just look like scribbles on a page. But like, no, this is an epic adventure right here.
Why do you think you do that? Like, what does it do for you, for your creative process?
I guess maybe I'm lazy about writing the character description. So if I can draw,
visualize,
yeah, I draw a curly haired girl and this is my ingenue, and I draw this, you know, evil looking face, and here's my, you know, antagonist, and I can just draw, and instantly looking at it, all the ideas are there in my head. It's just maybe I'm a visual learner, you know.
Sure.
So that's where I start, and then those notebooks, I start like you do sometimes too. I start writing by hand, but I tend to get on the computer. But I'll tell you, I'm cursed as a writer because I have terrible carpal tunnel syndrome. And when I'm sitting on the computer typing, it becomes painful. But then I tell myself, I'm suffering for my art.
Do you ever wear those?
I wear the braces when I sleep, and I just purchased some Dragon software so I can talk and have it type, and I'm hoping that that will maybe inspire. But I do feel like when I'm suffering, like I'm forcing myself to go, it's kind of
you're being an
noble.
Artist.
Yes, I'm noble. I'm not,
you're in the garret with yeah, the with the with the freezing and the
right. I'm not starving in the snow, but I'm like, oh, my hands hurt, but I must keep going.
I have thought about the voice activated software, and I don't know why, but it really scares me a little bit because, and it shouldn't, because as playwrights, it should be the most
dialogue.
Natural thing
yeah.
in the world that what you, because I know that that's why I succeed as a playwright. One of the reasons I succeed as a playwright is because I write the way people talk.
Right.
I don't write, I very poor grammar. I've not, you know, very, the structure of true sentences,
mm-hmm.
I don't do correctly at all.
Right.
Because I have that piece missing, what goes down on the page sound, I know when I look at it that it sounds natural.
And I'm the same way. That's why I just experiment with this software. The problem I have is I often read back what I've written. And so if I'm writing and I'm speaking and it's typing up, and then I read it back, I suddenly
it does get, it again.
Yeah, so I haven't mastered the process of actually shutting off the microphone. I actually took a phone call the other day, and I looked back, I recorded the entire phone call without punctuation, because you actually have to say period.
Oh.
You know, so if you don't, it just keeps going.
It just keeps going.
So I'm experimenting. I have not written a play yet on it, but I just received it in the last week, so I'm going to attempt to write a play using part of that, at least to see if I can, you know, it would,
yeah.
I think it's going to be great if you're doing a monologue and you just start
sure.
riffing and the monologue is there. But we'll see, you know, my process is not, it's not smooth. Sometimes I get jealous of you when I listen to you talk about writing and other writers with whom I've spoken that can get an idea and get that play out very quickly. And I tend to edit myself as I go, and I've just got to really break that habit so that, you know, I can, you know, like right now I haven't written a new play since Rinky
yeah.
Dink, and I always call it Rinky Dink, which is a bad nickname. It should be Epic Adventures.
It should be Epic Adventures.
I've written a play since Epic Adventures.
That's right.
It sounds much more, you know, palpable.
Big and
Rinky Dink. Yeah.
It's but, Greek.
But that's where the comedy comes in, the juxtaposition.
That's
of the
right.
Epic
that's right. That's
and the
right.
Rinky Dink. But I feel like I'm in a kind of a writer's slump, so I want to try something new just to kind of break out.
Just
of
to
it.
See what happens.
So,
see, but you know what? Grass is always greener, because I am a constant first scene rewriter.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of trouble getting to the end. And what I do is I book workshops. I have a new play that I'm like very futzing with right now. It's just sort of, I'm making a circle motion with my fingers that you can't see. I'm futzing with it. So I booked two new play workshops. I just go into a school and I just throw my script at them and we just sort of play with it.
Right.
So I booked it for December. So I have to do something
right. Well,
because otherwise
yeah,
we'll
teach,
just stare.
When I taught in the classroom, I could do that more often. Now I work for an online school. So I really, I don't have a student, you know,
no.
body where I can go, where I can't walk in. My friend Pam was actually doing the first production of
Epic Adventures.
Dun, dun, dun. Needs the music in the background. But I actually went into her school last year, and she was kind enough to have two drama classes read the play for me.
Yeah.
But we had, you know, basically the 40 minutes of
yes.
the classroom. So I had to get going and read, and I could take notes. And it was interesting listening to the students read them, because a lot of what I wrote actually really worked. It sounded like characters. But then there were a couple jokes that the kids just didn't get, that I thought, this is the best joke. And in fact, I had a joke that was a reference to both Dan Brown and Encyclopedia Brown, and it's in...
Well, that's too old, man.
Students would know Encyclopedia, but it was eighth graders, and there were like 60 of them, and only two of 60 knew who either Dan Brown or Encyclopedia Brown.
See, and that's so when it has
the joke,
to go.
It's gone. It was my favorite little reference. It was literary. It had to do with art. They're solving a mystery like Dan Brown and the, you know, Da Vinci Code. It was a perfect, and boom.
It is a perfect storm of a joke for that play.
It's gone.
And it's like, oh,
yeah.
So, dommage. It's so necessary to do that, like to go in and just sort of have them read. And because I used to do all my stuff when I lived in Toronto. I used to have a big group of professional actor friends, and we would come and do it. And it just got to a point when I really started to hone in on schools. It's like, well, professional actors are never going to do these plays. It's kids are going right. to do these plays. So we got
to
go
hear it in the authentic voice.
You got to go in and not only hear how they say it, but also, you know, they don't know how to filter their feedback.
Right.
They just tell you,
this sucks.
They tell you as it is, you know what, and you just have to take it. And that's how I know, you know, because that's just what people say to me a lot. And, you know, well, how do you know how to write for teenagers? I'm like, well, I get their instant feedback, and I'm the same way. I don't think my writer part of my brain is a teenager.
I don't think
teenagers, the core of what a teenager is, I just think has never changed.
It hasn't.
I think it's
10 years after I graduated high school and I started teaching, they were the same kids in the class. Technology was different. They dressed a little different, but their
heart is exactly the same.
It is.
And they all want is to be told they've done a good job at something, and they're so vulnerable, and they think that their worldly problems have no one else has ever done them.
Right.
And it's like, well,
and that's what my plays do. I try to latch onto those universal fears and joys of being a teenager, and the sarcasm that they always use, whether it's just to be mean or whether it's a defense mechanism. And you know, I'm talking really lofty, like
that's
these are deep meanings, but you know,
oh, but they are.
But
they're deep to them. It's their whole life.
It is,
you know, and I think that's something that I don't think there is a more enthusiastic or entertaining or truthful or just the high school drama production. The heart they put into it is just it's wonderful. I just think it's wonderful.
And they really are the best kids in the world. When if I judge like an acting competition or a playwriting competition, and I go to, you know, the Thespian Festival, when I see those kids, no matter how many times you see people on TV talking about, you know, this nation is going, you know, terribly, and kids, the future of the world is in bad hands. I look at these kids, and they're so supportive, and they're so loving, and they're so friendly, and they're so fun, and they're so adventurous, and they're so creative. I mean, those are the kids that, you know, I have faith that the world is going to be a better place when I look at these drama kids. I really do.
I feel exactly the same way. And it's like you can tell me till you're blue in the face that teenagers today are horrible. And I'm like, you know what?
Come with me and watch this rehearsal and look at these kids.
Just as high school students have not changed, I think they were horrible, horrible students in the 80s. I think they were horrible students in the 70s, horrible students in the 60s. Like, it's I just don't buy it. I don't buy that they're worse today than they were.
I agree. I mean, definitely with their technology and the fact that they're always latched to a phone, they're different. But those, like you said, those inner feelings are exactly the same. Unfortunately, they never left my brain either.
Yeah.
I say unfortunately, but I don't think it is unfortunate.
It's
love writing for teenagers. I mean,
Have you ever had to reconcile with the feeling of it's not real writing for schools?
No, because that's what I want to do. Like my friends, when are you going to write that novel? And I'm like, maybe someday. But right now, I have this great idea that I'd love to see on stage. I think kids would really, you know, if the kids can find a play to perform in, you know, the kids when in a school that they don't have anything else but dramas there. I love that providing a character that a student can identify with. And, you know, I want to play this part. I want to be in this production. Or I want to work backstage at this play. You know, I feel like, you know, just like being a teacher, people don't always look at that as a lofty thing or a noble thing. But, you know, I love writing for teenagers. I love teaching teenagers. I think that is, maybe it's not real art, but it's
depends.
A real passion.
I think that it's, well, people put, I think, lofty ideals on what art is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what art is something that impacts.
Right.
Right? And I think, without a shadow of a doubt, what we do with students has impacts. Not only does it impact, sometimes it changes their life.
It can.
You know? And I'm like, why would I want 3 weeks at a big theater when I can have somebody who was in a play and will remember that experience for the rest of their life?
And it's true. I remember my first play in the second grade.
Okay, tell me, what's your first play? What was your first play?
Well, I was not cast as a lead role. I was just a background elf, but the kid who played Santa Claus somehow took his, it was either a candy cane or this big sack of toys, and he whacked the reindeer in the head and basically got suspended from the play. I think maybe because I fit the suit, I was roughly the same height, but I was suddenly Santa Claus in the school play, and I haven't stopped acting since, you know, through elementary school, and I was in a play in the fifth grade where I had to do a magic trick for the audience, so I did that, and in high school, I was a detective in this mystery parody, and in college I was auditioned for Romeo and Juliet. I read really well for Romeo. I got cast as Paris, the guy who doesn't get the girl, and then I get killed by Romeo. So I've been acting, my whole life, and I love those plays. Some of the best friends I still have, in my 40s here, were people with whom I performed on stage. I look back fondly at it. I still have every program and every play I've ever been in. And I've accomplished things in my life. I have a beautiful wife. I have kids. But, if I think back at the greatest moments of my life, you're actually right. Those plays were a big part of it.
That community.
It is. Yeah, it made you who you are. The idea that you can get in front of an audience and say something, whether it's your words or whether it's the playwright's words, and affect that entire audience, have them gasp or cry or cheer. Boy, that's empowering. It makes you feel wonderful. It does.
It's something that never leaves you.
It's true.
Now, when was, did you ever have a defining moment when you felt, I'm a writer?
The first play, when my first play got the publication offer, that was kind of a nice moment. The most terrifying moment as a writer, I will tell you, is when the first time I went to a school who was performing one of my plays. I hadn't been involved with it at all. I just, I came in, I sat down. They said, "Hey, we have a special guest here, the author of the play." And I had to stand up, and people, politely clapped. And then I watched the production, and
it was
every beat was missed. And there, there were some really wonderful performers, but I think it was one of the earlier performances, and they hadn't really done it for audience, so there was no holding when there was a laugh. And I'm sure it was much better than what is my mind, but in my mind, I put it on the page. I had produced
it
several years before. It's my first play. And I finally got to the point now where I can go in and just enjoy it for what they are. And I've seen some amazing productions of my plays. I love them. That first time watching your words being interpreted by someone, with whom you had no contact, that was frightening. Afterwards, I revisioned it in my head, and it wasn't as bad as I thought. But that moment, sitting in the seat, every line they said, I'm like, oh, I should have rewritten that joke, or oh, they missed that punchline, or oh, no, that's not how the character should look. It was tricky. Now, with 10 plays under my belt, I'm much more relaxed, and I love watching a production of my play. I love meeting the students and answering their questions.
They're so appreciative.
They are. And
they love it. They love when you come. And they love, because we're alive,
Yeah.
And they don't, sometimes they don't make that connection. It's like, a live person wrote this, they're going to come and they might come and see it.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like disappoint them, though. They're expecting this author to come in a tie and a beard and a pipe and say, "Hey, I'm the writer of this play." And I'm just walking like, "Hey, kids.
Hey, how you doing?"
They're like, "Oh, that's him?
Oh, we don't like this play. Yeah, he's no good.
I no longer wish to be involved."
I don't think that at all.
I wonder, because I think when I was a student and when I was acting, I think that's how they envisioned I had it. The playwright, when we were doing Romeo and Juliet, I kind of had an idea what that guy was like. But the other plays always pictured the college professor,
smoke,
the beer and the pipe. And so me, I'm a goofball teacher who never grew up in that one part of my mind that writes. So I hope I don't disappoint them. But I really do. I hope that more students will discover these plays, because every play that I've seen performed, when I preach to the director, they always talk about how much the audience appreciated, how much the kids had fun. I'm not writing these plays that are changing the world, but, I'm writing a play that's really good night at the theater. I mean, it may change the kids who are in it, but, when you finish watching my play, I don't think there's 8 hours of conversation about the deep, dark meaning of the, but there's a lot of fun. The audience is enjoying them. The kids are playing characters which they can relate to and maybe they can learn from. So I have a lot of fun.
There is nothing wrong with a solid, entertaining evening of theater, because I have seen a lot of crappy theater.
Yes.
There are a lot of playwrights, a lot of, sorry, not writers, who put very little work into just putting out stupid crap. So I think it's a lot harder actually to write decent comedy and decent entertainment than it is to write, you know, it's easy to go to the
philosophical.
My mama's dead, you know, like it's I think it's easy to go there as a trick. It's a lot harder to create heartwarming, true, like sincere, heartfelt characters in a heartfelt comedy. I think that is a very hard thing to do, and it's wonderful to see. And I think he did just a fine job. So I don't think you should. Epic Adventures is by far just a lovely, and it's a lovely adventure, you know, with wonderful characters.
It has a little bit of mystery, a little bit of romance.
It's a little bit of mystery. Great humor, you know.
Well, you know, writing plays, all my plays
someone should publish that play.
Yeah, sure. I'm glad someone did. I just thought it would be funny. You know, every kid has gone on a field trip, and whenever you go on a field trip, there's always the educational part, and there's always the, like, we're out of school.
Slacking off.
We can get away with stuff. So that's why I try to capture, you know, that the different ways that students react when they're released from the classroom and they have a little bit of freedom. And here, running around the art museum, they can get into all kinds of, you know, nutty hijinks and mysteries and romances and...
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Well, there you go. And I think, oh my gosh, look at that. Ken, we've been sitting here chatting for like 25 minutes.
Yikes.
I know.
We'll have to just edit out all the dull parts.
And here we are, and we're done.
Thank you very much. Just flash the picture.
That's right.
It's pronounce my name, and we're done.
It's Ken. It's Proust. It rhymes with Seuss.
Right.
See, I'll never. Whatever
I say to a student, I say it's Mr. Proust rhymes with Dr. Seuss. They always end up calling me Dr. Proust. Which makes me seem way smarter than I really am, so I love it.
You should take that. I'm just like, Dr. Proust, you're right. I'll take it. Not a problem at all. All right, so now your job is to go out and write another play. So,
I shall.
So epically. And now you must do that.
I will. Now only write the epic part, not the rinky-dink part.
Thanks a lot, Ken.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for Ken Proust for taking the time to talk to me. What a lovely, lovely chat we had. So often, because we receive so many of our play submissions by email, there are playwrights with us who we have never met. We've only communicated electronically. And it's such a wonderful thing to sit down and have another talk with a playwright, particularly when you like their work so much. And that's where we're going to end. That's it. That's all. Take care, my friends. Take care.